It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll talk about how to be a language snob without being a jerk about it.
But first, the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia has ranked Wisconsin 20th in the U.S. for our economic growth outlook, and that's a big leap from our position of 40th back in April.
But it's all relative. So does that mean Wisconsin is doing better, or is everyone else doing a little worse?
Well, joining us now to talk about what those numbers mean and what Wisconsinites can expect from the economy in the coming months is Brian Jacobson, Associate Professor of Economics at Wisconsin Lutheran College in Milwaukee. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So according to the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, economy-wise, things are looking up. So, Brian, how good is this news?
Well, I would have to say that you have to really take that news with a grain of salt. The Philadelphia Fed's index, it's a leading index, and it's really focused on current trends. It's designed to forecast what they refer to as their coincident index 6 months ahead of time. And there's a lot of volatility in it. As you had mentioned before, Wisconsin was ranked, you know, below 40th in April's reading. Now they're up to 20th. States jump around all the time. And really, I think that that ranking itself is not, I don't want to say it's meaningless, but it doesn't really have a lot of substance to it.
So what could have happened in the past couple of months that caused us to jump 20?
Well, some of the things that could have happened would have been related to, if you look at how the index is constructed. They look at various measures related to employment. They look at manufacturing indices, various surveys, housing permits, things like that. And so one of the things that contributed to Wisconsin jumping up in the rankings was the housing activity that took place in Wisconsin. As far as the number of permits for new houses to be constructed where there's either going to be, you know, single family or up to four families living in a unit, so like with apartments. So that helped Wisconsin move up the rankings, but it doesn't necessarily point to sustainable or robust growth by any means just by looking at that one index.
So what would it take for you to say, yeah, this is pretty solid and we can start to pop the corks now?
Well, yeah, that would be kind of nice to do. And really, it's, you have to look at a wide variety of indicators. The Chicago Federal Reserve actually constructs an index that people might be interested in looking at. It's referred to as the Midwest Economic Indicator, and they break it out for a number of states in the Midwest who are in that Federal Reserve District. And they break out the economic activity into manufacturing, services, consumer spending, and construction. And based on that, I would really want to see broad-based gains across all of those various sectors of the economy. And where Wisconsin seems to be sort of lagging, not just nationally, but also within the Great Lakes region itself, is really on the manufacturing side, and believe it or not, even on the services side.
So services would be what, the tourist industry?
Yeah, that does feed into it as far as tourism. It can also be anything that is related to, let's say, government services, healthcare, education, financial activity, professional management of enterprises. So it's a really almost a grab bag of all things that a lot of people are actually employed in. Because even though we view ourselves as being very much of a manufacturing-based economy, we're not really. I mean, only about 19.6% of all employees in Wisconsin are employed in what are considered manufacturing industries.
So is that why you said, if you can believe it, because this is an area where we should, you know, theoretically be thriving in?
Exactly. And especially if you look at just the general increase in economic activity and manufacturing nationwide, you would expect that Wisconsin would sort of tag along with that. But when you actually get down into some of the nitty-gritty details, you'll notice that some of the strength in manufacturing is more tied to, say, the automotive industry. And that's why we can see Michigan advancing quite a bit on the manufacturing side, while Wisconsin hasn't to the same extent. Because if you look at Wisconsin industry, our biggest export out of Wisconsin is industrial and electrical machinery. And so that hasn't experienced the same bounce back as what the automotive industry has.
Well, let's put it into context a little bit. How does Wisconsin compare with other states in the Midwest?
Almost like you would like to, you have to look at each one individually, because Minnesota actually weathered the economic downturn fairly well. They have a fairly diversified economy, and plus there was also a run-up in commodity prices. They have a little bit more mining and natural resource exposure than what Wisconsin or some of the other states in the Midwest have. So they actually did fairly well. Illinois fared fairly well, but it was really Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio that experienced the bulk of the economic downturn and are beginning to come back. When I look at some of the other indicators, like let's say gross state product, which is just a measure of sort of the economic activity in each one of the states, Wisconsin ranks third in the Midwest, so behind Minnesota and Illinois, if you measure it on a per-person basis, so adjusting for population changes. So we're still ahead of, say, Indiana, Michigan, and also Ohio. But again, that's because of how deep the downturn was for those areas, especially tied to automobiles. Mm. So Wisconsin is actually doing a little bit better than some of the Great Lakes and Midwest region, but not quite as well as, say, Minnesota and Illinois.
Well, do you have an idea of how the most recent budget might affect Wisconsin's economy as we go forward?
It's really tough to tell because these some of the effects can be rather long-lasting. It's what we would call having a very long tail, in the sense that you make a change today and you might not notice a change in economic activity immediately. It might take a few years. And so one of the things that I think could be supportive in general would be the decline in the income tax rates. That, in general, will support economic activity. Obviously, then that creates other issues as far as, well, do you have to cut other services, which are valuable as well. So there's this cost benefit. So the tax cuts on their own, I think, could have some long-lasting positive implications. But one of the positive aspects to some of the changes was actually implemented last year, which was allowing for more capital-intensive businesses to get a little bit more of a tax deduction. So for the longest time, Wisconsin didn't allow certain businesses, well, I shouldn't say the longest time, back to 2005 when they could first start doing this, taking deductions for certain qualified domestic activities. Wisconsin didn't allow that same deduction on taxes like other states did, which I think could sort of explain why it is that we didn't experience the massive bounce back or job creation in the manufacturing and more capital-intensive industries like other states might have. It was the simple difference between tax differences between the states. I think that had a long-lasting implication.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for helping us make sense of it. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Brian Jacobson, Associate Professor of Economics at Wisconsin Lutheran College.
Next, we'll check the headlines, and then we're going to talk grammar and if it's possible to be a language snob without ticking people off. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday morning, Joy Cardine is joined by a guest who went on a year-long campaign to introduce her kids to five basic life skills. She'll talk about the ways meaningful work can increase self-confidence and concern for others. That's Monday morning at 8 on The Joy Cardine Show.
Noah Ovshinsky joins us now with a check of the latest headlines.
Islamists in Egypt are pushing back 2 days after President Mohamed Morsi was forced out by the nation's military. Tens of thousands of Morsi's supporters marched today in Cairo, demanding that he be reinstated. A health ministry official says 10 people have been killed and more than 200 wounded in clashes around the country. Prosecutors say they are resting their case in the murder trial of George Zimmerman, the neighborhood watch volunteer charged with fatally shooting Trayvon Martin. Over 2 weeks, prosecutors called more than 36 witnesses. Zimmerman's defense attorneys will now present their witnesses. And a researcher accused of stealing a possible cancer-fighting compound from the Medical College of Wisconsin has reached a plea deal with federal prosecutors. He's also accused of stealing academic research that he planned to pass off as his own in China. The charge carries a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. More news coming up in about 15 minutes.
Thanks, Noah. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.
Does poor grammar literally make your head explode? Well, if so, this next one's for you.
Bill Walsh knows a thing or two about reading and writing real good. He's a copy editor at The Washington Post, and his new book is Yes, I could care less. How to be a language snob without being a jerk.
And we'd love to hear from you on this one, too. What is your grammatical pet peeve? And how do you tell people about it without sounding like the grammar police? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Bill Walsh, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, Bill, let's start by seeing whether you can make the case for good grammar. You know, we're in this internet age when the premium is on getting information out there and getting it out there fast. So does proper grammar still matter?
It does, but it doesn't necessarily matter in a casual conversation between friends or in a casual email. And so that's where not being a jerk comes in. If your friend says, hey, you split an infinitive, that's wrong, you're free to hit back and correct that person that, no, it's not. But best not to start such arguments.
You have to pick your battles.
Right.
Well, you consider yourself a language snob. What is the top of your list for your grammatical pet peeve?
I like to explore those areas where people who think of themselves as sticklers start to get it wrong. I don't really care about it's and it's and there and there. Those are sort of like the compulsories, the figure eights that the figure skaters have to carve into the ice before they move into the more interesting stuff. One of my big ones is, and I saw this on the New York Times website a few days ago, Roger Federer is one of the few players who still uses a two-handed backhand. People say Roger Federer is the subject, so it has to be a singular verb. But no, he is one of the few players who still use. You're talking about all the players and saying that he is one of them. And so I go back and forth with would-be sticklers on this, and it's sometimes hard to get people out of that kind of sentence diagramming mode.
Now, I know you're using the word stickler here, which is a term popularized by Lynn Truss, who wrote the book Eat Shoots and Leaves, and she kind of made it okay to be a language snob and a language stickler. Do you think she did a service to language?
Well, I think too many people picked up that mantle and then went around defacing signs across the country with their Sharpies, and I think that's, again, being a jerk. And sometimes the popular causes that people pull out their magic markers for, again, turn out to be wrong. 10 items or less. People want to change that to 10 items or fewer because normally countable things are fewer rather than less. I say you don't have to read that as meaning 10 items or fewer items. It just means 10 items or less, period. 10 items or less than that. So I think actually changing that to fewer would be a mistake.
So you're a pragmatist about this.
I am.
Well, one that you have at the beginning of your book is this could or couldn't care less. You
right.
want to take that one apart for us?
That's one of two case studies, the other one being your head literally exploding. And, of course, when people say, I could care less, they generally mean, I couldn't care less. After all, if you could care less, that means you care a certain amount. Now, if you talk to the really smart people, the linguistics professors, they will say, absolutely nothing wrong with I could care less. It's an idiom. Idioms don't necessarily have to make sense. Smart people have been using that forever. This is kind of where I part ways with them. I don't think it's a coin toss. I think if you have two more or less equally common ways of saying something, there is value in picking the one that makes logical sense over the one that's going to earn you a raised eyebrows from other people.
And other people would say that, you know, language is a fluid thing. It's a living, breathing entity, and it's going to change. So why should we nail down one or the other?
And that's the trick. You need to, things are going to change, but you don't use a new usage because it's going to become accepted someday. You sort of have to take a survey, and that's what I try to do, of what will make you not sound so dumb right now at this present moment in time. And so my case study on that is your great-grandmother might have said, I was graduated from high school. You or I would probably say, I graduated from high school. But what do the kids say? I graduated high school.
Hmm.
Now, someday that will be correct, but I don't think that's a good reason to accept it right now. I think right now you have to say the state of the art is I graduated from high school. So I get to be a little bit of a jerk about that. If somebody says, I graduated college, I kind of want to say, no, you didn't.
Maybe after a couple glasses of wine, the grammar snob really comes out.
Right.
You have a funny one on that in that vein about... maybe one day loofah and falafel will come to mean the same thing, but that doesn't mean we should use them interchangeably.
That's
now.
Right. People who follow politics will know who I was referring to there.
Well, we've got some callers already. Let's take one now. We've got Andrew on the line with us from La Crosse. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going. I just have to say something that really annoys me is the word irregardless, because you just said the opposite of what you mean, because, you know, if it's regardless, you have no regard. If it's irregardless, it's without regard. So
which is not even the opposite. It's just kind of nonsensical, right? What would not regardless even mean? Well, regardful? So, that's one of the biggies.
Yeah. I just want to get that one off my chest. I also have a big problem with the one you were just talking about in regards of I could care less. So... thank you for fighting the good fight on grammar and proper word usage.
All right.
Thank you, Andrew. Yeah, I have to admit, when I read that part, you could care less or I couldn't care less, I thought, I wonder which one I use. And I think I have used the other one. Mm. That's not one that hasn't piqued my, radar yet. But now I'm glad I've read that. I'm going to correct it.
Yeah, we have different zones of awareness. I occasionally find myself saying something. I've been writing something stupid for decades, and oh, wow.
Yeah, and I suppose people really feel proud when they get you on one.
Oh, yeah.
What's one that you've recently discovered that you were doing wrong?
So the word segue, S-E-G-U-E. I was about to write something snotty correcting people who spell it S-E-G-W-A-Y, like the vehicle. What I didn't realize was that S-E-G-U-E-W-A-Y was not a word, because when I was 15 years old or so, when I first saw the word segue, I saw it spelled that way with the W-A-Y, and so I just thought S-E-G-U-E was seg, which was another way of saying segue, and that there was a short version and a long version, and that one kind of stunned me.
Isn't that where a lot of our blind spots come from?
That's what they are. They're blind spots. And so sometimes they come from pronunciation, and sometimes they come from just the way you've seen them written. And if you see something wrong the first time, it sort of imprints on you.
Right, or if you're reading, let's say you're just mispronouncing a word and you hear it in your head a certain way, and maybe you get to be 45 years old and you realize you say it aloud for the first time and everyone looks at you funny.
If you're a very literate person and you do a lot of reading, there's a good chance that there will be words in your vocabulary that you've never heard out loud.
Exactly.
And so I find myself saying sputum when I meant sputum, because that just doesn't come up in conversation. Someone corrected me on that about 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's not one of our most fun words in the
no.
language, is it? All right, let's go next to Anne. Anne's joining us from Hortonville. Hi, Anne.
Hi. This is great to have this show words that are pet peeves. One of mine is, me and Joe went to whatever, should be Joe and I. And you hear that all the time, even by people that are very learned. And
then people reverse it.
What?
People reverse it. They've been corrected so often on that version that when they should be saying me on the other side of the sentence, they say something bad happened to Joe and I, when in that case it really should be me.
You know, I have to say that's me. For some reason, talking about your blind spots, I know how to do it correctly, but I have to take a minute to sort it out, and by that time, my moment to speak is past.
You have to get Joe out of the sentence and say something. You wouldn't say something happened to I, you would say something happened to me.
Right, but see how long it took you to explain that?
Exactly.
That's how long it takes in my brain, and no one's willing to wait that long for me to figure it out. So
the
gears
are moving, the gears are working. Yeah.
I just say whatever comes out. So I apologize, Anne. You may hear that one day. Please forgive me. Let's go to Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. The guest was talking about in casual conversation, I guess you'd be kind of a jerk to be a stickler. And I completely agree. I think that sometimes we make people feel self-conscious or uncomfortable with their own educational level or something they say, and they close down when the diction isn't quite right. But at the same time, I think there's something really wonderful and rich about taking the time, even in casual conversations or in an intimate conversation, where you use the full faculty of the language and you really draw on the power of, you know, a wonderfully rich and obscure adjective, instead of just going for the quickest, most expedient, shortest hand version of communication. I think there's something about the language itself and the art form that the language represents that really, even in those casual conversations, can be really rich and rewarding.
And then when your friend says, "What the heck did that mean?" you can educate your friend without being a jerk. So, yeah, that's a constructive conversation.
Right. I mean, I think of language sometimes as using a paint palette, and you don't want to just paint with two colors. You want to paint with as many as you can. Maybe sometimes you want two colors, but it's more fun to have more colors, and, you know, digging into that palette of paint is fun.
Indeed.
Well, we are talking with Bill Walsh right now about being a language snob without annoying everyone you know. And we're going to pick up this conversation right after the news. And we want to hear from you. What is your grammatical pet peeve? You've got the right guest now. He can talk you through it. And how do you decide when to go about correcting grammatical offenses? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We've got news coming up from Wisconsin Public Radio, and then more of the conversation on grammar. Thanks for listening along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Bill Walsh is our guest, and we're talking about grammar and how to be a language snob without being a jerk. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@WPR.org. And we'll go to the lines now. We've got Kelsey joining us from Waukesha. Hey, Kelsey.
Hi.
What's your pet peeve?
I helped friends in college grading their papers, or like before they would turn them in, I'd proofread them. And people's incorrect usage of commas really, really, really drives me crazy.
Yeah, commas are interesting. I wanted to ask Bill about that, too. I mean, there's the rules, as we know them, as they are set down in stone somewhere, Bill. But I've also feel like I've noticed recently that editors are taking a more minimalist approach to commas as well. I don't know. What do you think about commas?
Well, commas are flexible. Just look at them. See how it'll bend there? No two people use commas quite the same way. There are some hard and fast rules, but there's a lot of room for flexibility there. But yes, when they're used really badly, it's really annoying.
Well, are you seeing? Is there such a thing as a comma trend? You know, do people either really like using lots of them? I'm talking maybe about the publications we see nationally, or decide, you know, we're getting a little comma happy. Let's dial it back.
It's hard to draw a pattern. It's such an individual thing. Some people get very, very touchy about the serial comma or the Oxford comma. So do you say red, comma, white, comma, and blue, or is it just red, comma, white, and blue? And so the lack of a serial comma is sort of a newspaper thing, and my career has been in newspapers, and that's what I tend to go to, and I don't really feel strongly about it, but a lot of people do.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kelsey. And we move to Adam, who is joining us from Madison. Hi, Adam.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. How about you?
Good. My pet peeve relates to using the word unique. And it always bothers me about every day I hear someone use the word more unique, very unique, totally unique. And I hear it from anyone from lawyers to government officials to even radio hosts at times. So I was wondering, what's so tricky about this about getting this word right?
Thanks. Unique.
So, unique is one of a kind, and so you can't be more or less one of a kind. You either are, it's like being pregnant. You're either unique or you're not. There is an asterisk there. You could maybe modify unique with the word like truly. Is something truly unique or is it not? But, yeah, in general, you don't want to be talking about more or less unique.
Isn't there room for hyperbole, though?
Well, that's where we kind of get into the literally thing. When I object to my head literally exploded, some people would accuse me of wanting to ban hyperbole. My headline on that chapter is, what do we want? Hyperbole. When do we want it? Yesterday. Sure, there's room for hyperbole, but I don't know. More very, very unique doesn't strike me as a really great, colorful use of it.
What about exclamation marks? Especially when you're texting someone, I guess I see it a lot, but it seems as though if you just use one, you're not that excited. To be excited now, you need three.
Or in email, if you don't use exclamation points, it just sounds kind of flat and dour. And so that's where the concept of register comes in. There's a register we use in conversation. There's a register we use in doctoral dissertations. And then there are all sorts of registers in between. And so email is developing its own kind of register where, in order to sound like a cheerful person, because just those letters on a screen can be so flat, we tend to use one or two or three exclamation points just to make it absolutely clear that, hey, I still like you. And so, I definitely find myself using exclamation points there where I normally wouldn't.
So you don't feel like it robs you of dignity? Sometimes I feel I'm less dignified based on the number of exclamation points.
It does depend on whom you're writing back and forth with, but just with friends, exclamation points can be a good thing.
All right. Well, let's go to Dan, who is with us from Eau Claire. Hi, Dan.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What is your pet peeve?
Well, I'm not so sure as a pet peeve, as an interesting observation. I wonder what Bill thinks of the polysemy factor of the English language.
So explain what you mean by that.
Polysemy means we have so many definitions for words in the English language that when we hear someone say something, we have to choose which meaning applies. A great example is, I love you.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Bill?
And so how would I love you, you mean sort of it can mean love, or it can mean you're my great pal, or?
Exactly. It depends on who we're loving, how we're loving.
Right.
It's maybe one of the most often used words in our language, but one of the most least defined, I think.
And it's important to, when I'm trying to dial back the peevers, I make the point that one word can mean a lot of things sometimes, and the same word can mean different things, and different words can mean the same thing. And so when you see, like, the Associated Press style book saying, a hike is a walk in the woods, a pay raise is not a pay hike, I kind of say, well, give me a break there. A pay raise can still be a pay hike. It's pretty clear. You know, or a suit is a article of clothing. A lawsuit is a lawsuit. Right? Everybody knows what a suit is, and everybody knows what a hike is in that context. And so that's where I sort of take the non-peeving approach.
I guess what you're saying, Bill, is that we all have our own tolerance thresholds.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to decide, you know, where our moral compass of grammar leads us.
An internal style book, and right. No two of us have the exact same one.
And that's why we drive each other crazy.
Indeed.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Dan, and to David in Madison. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, so my pet peeve is people who don't seem to know the difference between the words altitude and elevation. And I see a lot on television, even like the Discovery Channel talking about buffalo roaming at high altitude, and Coors Light had a commercial where they talked about their special barley grown at altitude, and it just made me think about airplanes full of crops flying around over Colorado. It just drives me crazy. They're two different words.
That reminds me of the principle that if you know more than the average person about any topic, you are going to find a lot of mistakes on that topic in the popular press and in the pop culture.
Right. All right. Well, thanks, David. It could be an interesting commercial if we did it your way, the plains full of crops. Let's go to an email next. This is from Jane, who has a question for you. She says, which is correct, I babysat for Anna or I babysat Anna?
So is babysit a transitive verb or an intransitive verb? I think you babysat Anna, but you babysat for her parents. I think there's room for context there, and that may still be evolving, but just at first glance, that would be my hunch.
All right. Well, there's a little bit of wiggle room there, Jane. Thank you for that. And Marilyn on Facebook says, my pet peeve is the overuse or incorrect use of apostrophes when just one means a plural. So apostrophes, that's one of those bugaboos that get a lot of people.
Right. That was a big Lynn Truss thing. And so if you go to the farmer's market, you'll see a lot of signs that say apple apostrophe S, two for a dollar or whatever. And that's a pretty basic thing. It's one of those rudiments that I don't worry too much about. But I caution the sticklers when they harumph that apostrophes mean possessive. They never mean plurals. Well, that's not true. Apostrophes can mean plurals. If you say, I got all A's in school, you don't want it to look like I got all A's, and so you put A apostrophe S. The plurals of individual letters are made with apostrophes. Do's and don'ts. Do's can be just D-O-S, but most style guides will call for D-O apostrophe S. So it's dangerous to state these rules too flatly. But yes, a lot of people do use apostrophes dumbly.
Okay, Marilyn, thank you for the comment. And Bill, thank you so much. I think we've all learned to be tolerant and also right.
Thank you.
So thank you. We've been speaking with Bill Walsh. He is a copy editor at The Washington Post, and his new book is called Yes, I Could Care Less, How to Be a Language Snob Without Being a Jerk.
The part of that conversation that really spoke to me was the exclamation point issue. I keep reading my email saying, I sound like this really boring, stuffy jerk unless I throw in a couple exclamation points, and then I feel like a dope if I do. You just can't win. Well, right after the break, we're going to check in with WPR news guy Noah Ovshinsky. He'll give us a recap of some of the top state news stories of the week. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Monday morning at 10, it's On Point. Wimbledon tennis matches are going on this weekend, and Tom Ashbrook will look at the evolution of tennis coming up Monday at 10.
And here's a check of the latest headlines with Noah Ovshinsky.
The secret spilling website WikiLeaks says NSA leaker Edward Snowden has put in asylum applications to six new countries as his effort to find refuge from American prosecution falters. Snowden is believed to be stuck in a Moscow airport transit area and has already sought asylum from more than 20 countries, including Venezuela and Ecuador. Pope Francis has cleared two of the 20th century's most influential popes to become saints. The pontiff today approved a miracle that was needed in order to canonize Pope John Paul II. And in the case of Pope John XXIII, Francis waived Vatican rules so he can be declared a saint, even though the Vatican hasn't confirmed a second miracle attributed to him. And Governor Scott Walker has signed a contentious Republican bill that would require women seeking an abortion to view an ultrasound of the fetus before the procedure, and it also prohibits doctors from performing abortions unless they have admitting privileges at a local hospital.
Thanks, Noah.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We just heard some of the latest news from Noah Ovshinsky. Now he joins us to bring us up to date on this week's news from Wisconsin.
Noah, thanks a lot for joining us again.
It's good to be here, Rob. Thanks for the invite.
Sure. And now let's look at some breaking news. The governor signed some abortion legislation this week, and there's a threat of lawsuits out there.
Yes, he did. Actually, just a few hours ago, it was publicly announced that he did sign the abortion legislation that recently just came out of the state capitol. It requires patients to have an ultrasound before an abortion. It also requires doctors to have admitting privileges at a hospital that's located within 30 miles of a clinic. And that has huge implications for the availability of abortions here in the state. And people who watch these things have said that that particular part of the legislation was designed to shut down a clinic in Appleton.
And that's what they're worried will happen, that this will actually put a couple out of business, in effect. Now, why is this such a tough regulation, according to critics of this bill that the governor just signed?
Well, because, you know, once those clinics are shut down because of this rule that was just signed into law, they'll just be far fewer places where women can seek abortions in the state. In fact, from my math, it looks like there'll only be three clinics left, all in the southern part of the state. There'll be two clinics in Milwaukee and I believe one in Madison that's left. And Planned Parenthood threatened, and I'm assuming now will inevitably file a lawsuit against the state seeking to stop that legislation from going into effect.
And these admitting privileges, it's not like I'm a doctor, I'm working at one of these clinics, I'm just going to bop over to the hospital and get these privileges. It's not that easy?
It's not that easy. First, you know, a lot of the hospitals in Wisconsin are affiliated with Catholic organizations, and, you know, more likely than not, they won't admit doctors who perform abortions. Also, you know, many times physicians are required to admit a minimum number of patients to a hospital in order to get those admitting privileges. Of course, that's probably not a really realistic thing for doctors who perform abortions. And also the process itself to become admitted, can take 3 to 6 months. And so basically this rule all but, you know, shuts down these clinics.
And this is not something that's just happening here in Wisconsin, right?
Right. These bills that require doctors to have admitting privileges at hospitals, it's part of a nationwide strategy by abortion opponents to really limit access to the procedure. It's not just happening here. It's happening in several other states around the country.
And this is something that the news department's going to be watching as it moves into the courts now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, speaking of courts, and you mentioned the state budget a few minutes ago, that residency rule in Milwaukee that was part of the state budget, it's not a done deal. First, what was the change in the budget?
Yeah, basically, and this is one of, you know, several examples of policy that was included in the budget. And basically what it really did was it really rolled back the ability for municipalities to have residency rules for their workers. And what Milwaukee officials basically said this week is they're going to ignore the residency language in the budget, and they're going to still require firefighters and police to keep living in the city. And of course, more than likely, this too will lead to the courts.
And this is something the Common Council did this. Mayor Tom Barrett signed
it. Yeah, quickly signed it.
What's their grounds? They say we don't care, or do they say they have a leg to stand on here?
Well, the mayor says basically the state constitution has a home rule provision that allows communities to have residency laws. And that's what they're going to argue in court should it go that far.
So somebody's probably going to sue somebody here. I could see
Absolutely.
Either the state, I guess, bringing suit against Milwaukee, or maybe I'm a firefighter, I'm shopping in the suburbs. I might want to sue the city and say, hey, the state gives me the right to do this now. What's up?
Right. Well, according to Chuck Kornbach, who reported for us on the story, union officials are telling their members to, you know, proceed with caution if they plan on buying a house in the suburbs, because we don't know how this is going to shake out.
Does this happen every couple of years? How much of our policy ends up having to play its way through the courts? I mean, well, of course, with Act 10, the big budget repair bill a couple of years ago, every part of that, it seemed like, was in the courts for a long time. Still is.
In a word, Rob, a lot.
A lot. To be technical.
Yes.
To be really technical.
Very technical. Very legal.
Okay, now moving outside of laws passed by the state government, frac sand mining, you have some updates on this big story that a lot of people are following.
Right. Well, of course, this also happens to do with the weather. And one of the issues that have plagued the frac sand industry here in Wisconsin is how they deal with stormwater. You know, how do they deal with wet weather? Because what can sometimes happen is, all this weather mixes in with the frac sand that's been mined, and it creates these mudslides. And sometimes that sediment makes its way into streams, rivers, lakes, wetlands. And what happened with all this recent flooding and heavy rains was that six frac sand facilities here in the state were determined by the Department of Natural Resources to have violated stormwater permits by allowing this sediment to leak into the nearby bodies of water. So clearly this is an issue that continues to be an issue for the industry. I don't know if you remember from last year, Rob, that the stormwater management issue made headlines when a mine in Trempealeau County created a mudslide during a heavy rainstorm, and that mud actually damaged a neighboring property. So clearly, this issue continues to plague the industry, and this rain and this flooding just makes it worse.
So what is the DNR saying? Are they saying, well, you know, there's too much rain, there's nothing you could have done about it, but it's still on you? Or are they saying, hey, you weren't prepared, you didn't do enough to manage this?
Right. Well, it's both. They say, obviously, the rain is partially to blame, but the DNR says also that, you know, poor runoff management is also a contributing factor. And the DNR is suggesting that, you know, sediment barriers aren't nearly as effective as they need to be, and that the industry needs to really look at, actually containing this frac sand in a way that when there are heavy rains, that the sand won't make its way into waterways.
And what can the DNR do? What kind of enforcement options are there? Are we talking fines, shutdowns?
Well, they have issued what's called an enforcement action, I believe, or I should say a notice of violation to many of these companies. And in rare instances, the DNR could consider referring the case for prosecution to the Department of Justice. And although two cases from last year that they did pursue haven't gone anywhere. So that's another step that they could take. But at least in this instance, haven't taken that step yet.
And this could be something that might be an impetus for the people who've been protesting this mining of sand for use in fracking. You've told us in the past about some counties who have limited frac sand mining in certain areas, I think, mm-hmm. along the Mississippi.
Yep, Pepin County.
Does this give, more ammunition to critics of this mining?
Right. Of course, you know, whenever there's news, you know, that casts the industry in a bad light, and obviously this kind of runoff does, mm-hmm. The people who don't like the industry are going to, you know, put this forward as just the latest example of why this industry is bad for the environment. It's bad for the state. Of course, there are other complaints that these folks have having to do with air quality and, you know, the effect that the industry has on roads and other infrastructure. But this is just another issue that they seize upon as an illustration of what this industry has done to the state, in their view.
This is a fairly new industry for Wisconsin in the big picture. Are we kind of state government, local government, and people who live in these areas kind of playing catch up on figuring out what we do about this?
I think as a state and certainly as counties, we're still figuring it out. Mm-hmm. It is such a new industry, and the state has largely left it to the counties to decide how to deal with these operations. And so every county is figuring it out as they go along.
Now let's move from frac sand to Sand Island. How's that for a transition?
Nice. Well done, Rob. I like it.
You told us about a bear situation up in the Apostle Islands. What's going on up there?
Right. That's right. The National Park Service announced that they were closing Sand Island, which is a popular part of the island chain for campers, that they were closing it to campers indefinitely because of either a problem bear or problem bears. They haven't been aggressive to humans yet, but they are causing a lot of trouble. They're getting into tents. They're getting into food. And in one case, a bear actually made its way onto a person's boat. And so the National Park Service just wants to be, of course, as safe as possible and has just closed the island down to visitors.
And that's kind of big news on a holiday weekend.
Yeah, of course. I mean, a lot of people are traveling up north or they're visiting the Apostle Islands. And, of course, nobody wants to hear that bears are becoming problem animals, you know, because they are just like the humans that visit the islands. You know, they have a right to be there just as much as the humans. And, in fact, in a lot of cases, I learned when I was researching the story that the bears actually swim from the mainland. They swim across Lake Superior to the islands. It's really amazing.
Wow. And part of what the DNR is doing, it isn't just to protect the humans from the bears, but to keep bears at more than arm's length from the humans.
Absolutely. It cuts both ways. You know, I think what's going to happen next is obviously they've closed the island to traffic. And when they have a chance, you know, they're going to try to, the National Park Service, that is, you know, they're going to go out and they're going to try to train these bears, you know, to keep a distance, you know, by using non-fatal, you know, ways to do that. I don't know how you train a bear, but they have some experience doing it. So,
all right. And then I want to end by looking ahead. I ran into Kristen Durst this morning. She was on her way out to cover her part of a series you all are working on heroin in Wisconsin. Can you give us a little taste of what's coming up?
Right. We have a series that's kicking off on Wisconsin Public Radio on July 15th. It's going to be a 5 or 6 part series looking at different aspects of the heroin epidemic here in the state. Of course, it's an issue that is just it's become a really big issue in the state. There are a lot of overdoses, a lot of accidents associated with heroin. And we're going to look at several different elements of that story. We're going to be talking about, of course, how did we get here? How did this become a problem? We're going to talk about how it's treated in the courts. We're going to talk about how Madison is treating, some organizations in Madison are treating it as a public health issue as opposed to a criminal issue. So we're going to be covering a lot of different parts of this big and still developing story. And that launches July 15th.
And we're going to be carrying that here on Central Time when it comes
out.
Yep,
absolutely.
All right, Noah, thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. It was a pleasure.
That was Noah Ovshinsky, our assistant news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio. He'll join us each week at this time with a look at what's up in Wisconsin news.
Coming up, a lot of today's young adults grew up with Harry, Hermione, and Ron, and our guest says the Harry Potter books were a powerful influence on their political views. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.